Welcome on to a somewhat somber edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. After the Cavaliers defeat the Hawks 97-89. Somber because I feel compelled to lead off with the Damari Carroll injury. Hopefully it is not serious, but all indications are that it may well be. He drove for a layup in transition midway through the fourth quarter and planted his left leg to take off. And it basically buckled, and he was in great pain, had to be helped off the floor, couldn't put any weight on it, and, definitely something that you would have to believe, based on all the available info right now, looks like a very serious knee injury. Danny, joining me today, this is all the worse because of what Carroll's contract situation was.
Yeah, I mean, it's really tough in any circumstance to see somebody who's so important to their team go down, especially early in a playoff series before anything was resolved. But the fact that he was going to be a free agent this summer, I mean, just like I felt so bad for Wesley Matthews, in some ways I feel even worse for Damari Carroll because of how excellently he had played during this postseason so far. I mean, to me, he, on the aggregate, had been Atlanta's best player.
Yeah, Carroll, even really worse than Matthews, because Matthews has already made a pretty good chunk of change as a restricted free agent after his first year in Utah. He got signed to an offer sheet, and he's made, well into eight figures in his career. And so, but Carroll has never made more. He made about $5 million over the last 2 years. That was really his first go at a contract above the minimum. He's already 29. It's been unbelievable work by him to become the player he is, have a career year that late in 29, because NBA players usually peak between 25 and 27. So with that being the case, this was going to be his chance for a payday. Hopefully it still will be. He was really in line for maybe as much as eight figures per season on a 2 or 3 year deal with his ability to shoot the ball and defend it at a above average rate on the wing. Not too many of those guys around. So really a shame for him. Hopefully there's still some hope that he may not be too seriously injured, as David Aldridge reported on TNT. Probably the reason for that is they'll do what's called a Lockman test. And that basically is you hold the top of the thigh with one hand, hold the back of the leg with the other hand, and basically pull towards you to see how far forward the shin goes in relation to the thigh. And if there's an end point there, that usually means you have an intact ACL. If it's kind of mushy, that's how they get an idea that your ACL might be torn. Maybe that test was inconclusive, and that might be the reason for some modicum of optimism, but I'm sure, an MRI tomorrow will tell us for sure.
Well, you having the knowledge of that, sadly, from personal experience is one of the benefits that you have of doing the show. I mean, you're somebody who I go to when I hear things about, those kinds of injuries. And so, I mean, I honestly, thankfully, know very little about it.
Yeah, well, and, if any doctors listen to the show, you can correct me. I'm obviously not a doctor, but have some experience and done a little research on this stuff. So then, Atlanta, not looking too good in this series now, having lost game one at home and having one of their best players, the guy who was going to guard LeBron James, you would have to imagine whether it's a serious knee injury or not after that, probably going to be out for the series.
Yeah, and that's the big part of it. You hope that it's not something severe, but even if it's on the lighter range, to me that still feels like he's going to be out for the series. And this, I like, before the injury, the big thought in my brain was it was such a great example of how this is a make or miss league, because that third quarter in that last 5 minutes when Josh Smith went crazy, almost all of his shots.
J.R. Smith.
Got my Smiths confused. And when J.R. went off, his shots were contested, but they went in. And in that same sequence, I just chuckled when I watched it. Dellavedova and James Jones had wide open threes and they missed. And so it's like JR is making all these ridiculous shots and you have these two guys who can hit those shots just miss completely wide open ones.
Yeah, it's true. And also worth noting, the Hawks 4 out of 23 from three-point range in this game. And, I mean, to me, the greatest surprise was how well Cleveland was able to defend Atlanta. Now, you might say that that's just the Hawks missing shots. But, you know, I mean, there's nobody, none of those guys who were missing, Korver was 2 out of 4. You can't say that any of those guys who were missing are unbelievable three-point shooters. You know, they take them. They're more takers than makers. You know, Millsap was 0 for 3. Carroll 1 for 4. He's been shooting a little better than that. Teague 1 out of 6. You know, not too far below what you might expect from him. Maybe you would make one more of those. And Schroeder 0 for 3. So with that being the case, you know, maybe Cleveland is going to be able to defend this team, which we didn't think, especially in the first half. Why do you think Cleveland was able to stop the Hawks other than just the poor three-point shooting?
Well, yeah, it was surprising because in the first half, the story for me was switching, and I thought that the Hawks did a great job exploiting that, you know, that when Cleveland had somebody other than their guards, and I don't have a single thing that I can point to. I don't know if it's worthy of giving him some credit. I thought Dellavedova did a nice job in this game. Like, I thought Kyrie obviously was not Kyrie, but I thought, and Tristan Thompson wasn't, he's not the greatest defender, but I think that Cleveland is just, they just have the athletes in some ways, you can say. So, like, I was talking with Robbie Calland, who covers the Hawks more regularly, and he was talking about how J.R. Smith did a nice job on Korver in the regular season. And so I think in some ways that is the advantage to having, let's say, above average athleticism at just about every position.
Yeah. This just came across the wire. Maybe not just, but Budenheiser said that Carroll has a knee sprain and MRI tomorrow. So that's could be good, could be bad. I mean, at least they're not that's a little more optimistic than you might have expected, but even still, given the pain that he was in, you'd have to imagine that at the very least he'll be out for a significant amount of the series, if not the whole series. And, you know, there still could be more damage revealed by the MRI as well.
Yeah, you hope for the best, but at least it wasn't bad news this early, so I'll take some solace in that.
Yeah. Well, I think that the Cleveland defense, another reason that they were really able to stop the Hawks was they kept them nearly totally out of transition.
Yep.
And Atlanta had only 9 fast break points. Not a ton for them. They usually like to get a lot of threes in transition. And one reason that they couldn't get out in transition was the Cavs' offensive rebounding. Tristan Thompson, again, was just a monster. And then Atlanta was forced to send all their guards back to the defensive backboard. Thompson was either getting offensive rebounds and slowing the pace, or at least preventing a clean defensive rebound and an outlet as well. So with all that going on, it really hurt Atlanta's running game, and the pace overall was very slow in the first half, only 45 possessions, which is quite slow for and Atlanta played at a faster pace compared to Cleveland. Cleveland slowed things down and was able to succeed in scoring with their kind of ISO bully ball while slowing the pace for Atlanta on the other end.
Yeah, and one of the remarkable things you and I talk about, you know, the differences between the types of turnovers that you can have is that Atlanta had scored 9 fast break points, and they had 6 steals. Steals are generally pretty reliable fast break point generators because they're live ball and everything else. And even with that, they still were held down. And for me, the major stretch defensively for the Cavs was at the end of the third quarter. There was, I believe it was 7 minutes where the only field goal that Atlanta made was that Kent Bazemore baseline dunk, which was a pretty nice dunk. But when you can go that long, yeah, they were still getting some free throws. And so it wasn't, you know, like a blank O run or anything like that. But it's hard to get into a rhythm. And especially when the other team is making these ridiculous shots, that's the type of thing that can swing a game.
Atlanta's bench struggled again. Kevin Arnovitz, as he so often tweets during these games, has been covering the Hawks all playoffs. Only 5 minutes together for the Hawks starters in the first half, in which they played very well. They were plus 7. They were minus 7 throughout the rest of the time, any other units other than the starters. And part of the problem was that Coach Bud took out Al Horford with 2 minutes left in the half because he's just incredibly conservative. He was on 2 fouls I'm going to start saying that, by the way. I'm going to say on two fouls. It's more European than has two fouls. We'll see how that goes. But he took him out just for those last 2 minutes, and that was not a great period for the Hawks, where there were a couple plays where Cleveland scored inside on Muscala that Horford might have been able to stop during that time. So, you know, I think that really that's not the time to be conservative. And, of course, Horford ended with, guess what, two fouls.
Yeah, I mean, and especially in a game like this where obviously they didn't know about the Carroll injury, but you knew that it was going to be a game that you needed all hands on deck. It makes it even worse in some ways for me to do what they did.
Now, the plan was, I think, he put in Korver and Horford right at the end of the third quarter, which he usually does with like a minute or two left, and they played the entire rest of the game,
correct,
which made sense. And they got up to a pretty high minute total. Obviously, they weren't able to have the starters out there with Carroll's injury, but really it was still those times when the bench killed them. And, you know, you can get on Coach Bud for not playing the starters enough together as a unit, but the bench does have to play a little bit. I mean, these guys weren't playing incredible amounts of minutes. Antic played 10 minutes. He's minus 10. Bazemore was even over 16 minutes, although he played a lot with the other four starters during that kind of crazy comeback at the end. Muscala minus 12 in 10 minutes. Schroeder, 2 out of 10 from the field, minus 13 in his 18 minutes. So really, I mean, the starters all played at least 36 minutes, other than Carroll.
Yeah, so exactly. And that's something that is a challenge for coaches, is, you know, how you want to balance that, especially we're seeing teams, the Cavs in this game, the Warriors largely went to an 8-man rotation, is that if you're going to go to an 8-man rotation, obviously you have to be meshing those guys with the starters. And it's a challenge because sometimes those lineups work. I actually thought in the first half, Schroeder Teague worked better than it has at other points during the playoffs. Granted, I'm still not sold on it. But yeah, I mean, if you're going to do that sort of thing, then you're going to be doing those heavily mixed lineups, and sometimes it works. And I wish that, you know, I'm still a believer in Mike Scott, but, you know, apparently there's something there. But if you're going to have to keep at least two starters on the floor, then those are the consequences you're choosing to have, which is fine. You know, it's justifiable. It's just different.
Well, we're probably spending a little bit too much time on Atlanta. I did think they started off very well. They were able to abuse the switching because of the shooting that they had on the floor. Timofey Mozgov wasn't really effective in that first half because he was worried about Horford shooting, and Teague was able to get to the basket against those switches. Millsap was a little bit as well, though he ended up finally being 3 of 11. He did get to the line 10 times. But Cleveland was able to get it going offensively. And I don't think that you can really, you know, while Smith was hot, and maybe you say as a Hawks fan, he's not going to shoot like that again. Well, Dellavedova and James Jones aren't going to shoot, and Shumpert aren't going to go, you know, a combined, 0-for-10 or whatever it was on pretty much all wide open looks. So it evened out. They only shot 39%, not, you know, certainly a good number, but nothing incredibly out of the ordinary. But it was really the offensive rebounds in that first half that kept them in it, getting to the foul line. And that was, I thought, the Hawks' opportunity to really build a lead, and they just couldn't do it. And then Cleveland locked in defensively in the second half.
And the other thing when you think about these two teams is that Atlanta had attempted and made more free throws than the Cavs. And so if you're talking about regression to the mean, I feel like that will, especially if Damari Carroll is out, which we expect, I expect that to tilt back the other way as well.
I concur. Big story to come out of this, though. Kyrie Irving, only 27 minutes, really looked extremely hobbled defensively. He was unable to keep up with really anyone. Maybe when it was Schroeder, he was okay going under the screen. But Teague totally abused him. They had to just switch on those pick and rolls because Kyrie was getting beaten so badly. So maybe that's where your greatest amount of hope comes from. If you're the Hawks, is that Kyrie is not going to be able to give them anything, but you're still going to have to score more than 89 points. And it was only 89 because they had that big flurry at the end. If you're going to hope to beat this Cleveland team, no matter how Kyrie plays.
we talked previously, I guess you could call it stumped a little bit for Houston to run a no point guard offense. And I think that while Dellavedova, I thought he did all right in this game, I think that Cleveland can do that too. They're another one of the rare teams that has a primary ball handler that can defend other positions. And I would love to see them run some Shumpert, JR, LeBron, and then whoever else they want to run, because Shumpert, I think, is better most of the time defensively on ones. And so Teague isn't perfect for him. You know, that's not exactly the right fit. I think he's better on a little bit of a bigger guy, but I think he can do a good enough job. And so I think we'll see more of that if they want to nurse Kyrie back a little bit.
LeBron started off really hot in this game. He was able to just kind of back down Carroll and score in the post quite a bit. He didn't have as many assists as he was having throughout the Chicago series. He did have four turnovers as well. I think that what he was able to do against Carroll really shows you how good Butler actually defended him in that series. But they also made a more concerted effort to go into the post than they had, with James's jumper still not really working very well. But yeah, I mean, I think that the Cavs, they're just playing this like 90s game. They hit the offensive glass way harder than everyone else, like they did back in the 90s. They're backing down into the post, like basically like it's still the old illegal defense rules, and LeBron is just so good at it and such a good passer that he can take advantage of the defensive 3 seconds almost like it's the old illegal defense rules. It's not very pretty to watch, frankly, but it's been effective so far.
Yeah, and in some ways it's kind of fun to have a periodic flashback. You know, I think that they've done that. It's kind of weird how in some ways necessity has been the mother of invention for them, and that they're running this offense, because it feels different to me than it did when they had Love out there, even though Love was underutilized and I whined about it constantly. And Tristan Thompson, it's fun for me. I love offensive rebounding. I think it's something that can makes the game interesting. It when a shot goes up, you have a different level of anticipation. And we've seen him bail out some really horrible Cleveland possessions by getting an offensive rebound. And there were some where he's, you know, that kind of ISO nonsense and they just get a bad shot. And then Tristan Thompson gets the ball. And it's kind of like that terribleness never really happened.
Yeah. And then they just run off. And that's part of the reason why these Cleveland games are so slow too. I mean, number one, they'll run the clock all the way down. But then number two, they get an offensive rebound and they run the clock all the way down again. But Tristan Thompson deserves a lot more credit than I think even we've given him.
Agreed.
On this podcast. What were your thoughts on him coming into this year?
I thought there's a group of people that I generally dislike as players, and that's people who are power forwards who don't really protect the rim and aren't reliable scorers. And I mean, he's a great offensive rebounder. I never think of him as a particularly dominant defensive rebounder. That might not be borne out. That might just be my own personal thing. So those types of guys are the guys that I always go, oh, they're going to get overpaid. So what I thought with him was he's a good player. He has the potential to get better. But I was just saying, this is exactly the type of guy with his close relationship with LeBron's camp and everything. It's like, oh, he's going to get overpaid and all this stuff. And I hadn't really appreciated what he brought. And he's also brought it a lot more during these playoffs.
I agree with you. I thought at the start of the year that he's basically a guy with center skills on offense and power forward skills that weren't even really that great on defense. But he's evolved so far beyond that defensively.
Yep.
His ability to switch out on guys has been a revelation for me. Granted, he got beat a little bit by Teague in this game, but that's by a team that has a lot of shooting around it. Against the Bulls, he was fantastic in that role. He also has been blocking a lot more shots than you might have expected. And then offensively, and then in the post too, that's been another thing. I mean, he's been able to stop Horford. He stopped Millsap pretty well. Pau Gasol has never had much success with him all year. He's just got a lot of lower body strength and is able to avoid getting pushed down. He's got long arms and has protected the basket pretty well too. And then on offense, he's just an offensive rebounding monster. So really, he's held up as a center defensively and also been able to switch on the perimeter, really a guy who has been invaluable for them in this postseason, and he'll probably end up being worth the contract that he gets signed to, or pretty close to it.
And what's great about him in the Cleveland kind of system is that I love him as a third big man because he can kind of sub for both positions and he has that versatility, and he can fit really well offensively. I don't love it defensively, but with more of a stretch four in that sense. Like, I feel comfortable with him now at the end of the season playing with Love or playing with Mozgov, and that's a rare commodity for a guy. You know, you don't see that many non-elite players who have that versatility.
Another thing that came out of this game, once Carroll went out, LeBron was at the four. Cleveland went to their lineup with only one big, and LeBron truly playing the floor. They didn't mess around with James Jones at the four. They put Paul Millsap on him, Atlanta did, and actually had some success. Millsap at least is strong enough to avoid getting back down by LeBron. And I think LeBron is not, he didn't really try to get him in the post, but also LeBron's post game is, it's a whole different animal trying to post up a big guy who's actually used to defending a guy that size in the post. So you kind of need a little bit more advanced of a post game, and not to say that LeBron doesn't have that, but it's rare that he tries to post up against power forwards. So then he was going against Millsap out in the perimeter. Millsap had a pretty good job against him, basically, and was able to stop him quite a few times in isolation. What did you think of that matchup, and do you think it's something that the Hawks can go to more often now, especially with Carroll looking like he's going to be out for quite some time?
I was impressed with how well Millsap did. He's an underrated defender, I think, broadly. It's something that I openly admit to underrating him at various points in the past. There were some times where I thought he went too far out on him. I think that when you're a four defending LeBron, you want to kind of bait him a little bit more into jump shooting, even if you give him that space and he can use it to build up head of steam a little bit. Because he's also really good at drawing fouls in those circumstances. So even if you're defending him well, sometimes he'll get that call, especially when he's being defended by a bigger guy. I mean, usually you think of LeBron as bullying a guy, but when he's playing the four, sometimes you get those Millsap situations. But yeah, I think if Carroll's largely or completely off the table, I think Millsap is a good option. It gets really sticky when LeBron's playing the three, you know, like, because if LeBron's playing the three, then you can't really justify that in the same way.
Right.
And so in some ways, it's kind of crazy that I think the counter in that way for Cleveland is just to go more traditional, because then without him and without Thabo Sefolosha, which of course now we can talk about more about how important that injury is they don't really have that guy, because Kent Bazemore is a good defensive player. Kent Bazemore is a 1-2 defender, not a 2-3 or even a 3-4 defender. And, I mean, you need a special person to guard LeBron anyway, and those guys are just falling by the wayside for the Hawks, unfortunately.
Yeah, you make a great point that when the Cavs start with their starters, Mozgov and Thompson, that Millsap can't guard LeBron. They'll just get destroyed on the offensive glass if they do that. And also, I think Millsap is someone who's going to get pretty tired. He's not used to that from a mental standpoint. And we saw it on the last play of the game or the last competitive play of the game where LeBron iced it with that dunk. Millsap was guarding him out near half court and should have forced him into the screen by Thompson. He didn't do that. LeBron rejected the screen. The help from Horford was there for him to use the screen, and that's how he was able to get right down Main Street and dunk that. So it was that's sort of an example of the type of stuff that big guys aren't really used to doing, defending on pick and roll, defending guys coming off of pin downs, off dribble handoffs, those sorts of actions. Now, of course, LeBron doesn't actually run off any screens really anymore. Maybe he'll run a pick and roll, and that's about it, but I think the longer the series comes on, if they really use Millsap on him a lot, that Cleveland will figure that out ultimately by running more of those actions if that's what it takes, or just Millsap just wearing down from guarding LeBron in isolation over and over and over and over and over again.
Well, yeah, and the other thing, as you talked about with that play, is that Horford was up there, you know, doing his job. And so what that meant, because when you have two guys that are, the two bigs are even with LeBron at, let's say, the a little bit past the free throw line, they're not getting back. You know, they're not getting there. And then Korver, of course, they were, the announcers were having jokes with it, but that he, you know, kind of ran away from the play in that sense. I mean, he wasn't going to do anything anyway. But
yeah, no, I mean, it's like, even if you foul him there, you're already, I think, you know, up, you're down four. Even hitting a free throw is probably death if you foul him. He's not going to block his dunk. No. You might as well go for the high-risk strategy of trying to intercept a potential pass to the corner. And he was also guarding the red-hot J.R. Smith as well. So you understand why that happened. It wasn't Korver's fault. The failure was at the point of the attack.
Well, and Korver, in that circumstance, this is something we see so much with LeBron. The contact that he would have made that almost definitely feels like would have been called probably wouldn't have been enough to stop LeBron from taking a shot. And so then you're also opening up the possibility of an and one. And so not only then do you have the 2 points with the free throws or whatever, but you have the possibility of three. And when you're talking about the margin, I believe it was 4 points when that happened. Then you're starting to think about seven, which is part of what he was trying to mitigate with J.R. Smith in the first place.
Well, so do you think the Hawks are sunk in this series now?
They're close. I mean, if Kyrie is basically ineffective, at least largely ineffective, that opens the door a little bit because that's putting so much creation pressure on LeBron and theoretically J.R. Smith. I mean, if J.R. Smith can do that. But if Carroll doesn't, let's say he doesn't play in the rest of the series, they're just running out of manpower. I mean, so are you going to start giving minutes to John Jenkins? I mean,
they're probably going to start Bazemore.
I assume they'll start Bazemore, which then means Korver defensively is almost a straight three. So then are you going to put him on LeBron James? I mean, that
no, it'll be Bazemore.
Yeah, but Bazemore, I mean, we saw it in the later part of the game. I mean, LeBron just Bazemore does great effort. I've actually talked with him about defense a lot because he used to be on the Warriors, but he doesn't have the size to do that. I mean, it's going to be more of one of those kind of pest circumstances. So, yeah, I mean, if they're going to go with that, it's going to be tough. And so I'm not going to write them off, but it's close.
Yeah, I mean, I think what they're going to devolve to will be, and they started the game this way as well. They were actually switching that 1-3 pick and roll quite a bit and ending up with Teague on LeBron or Schroeder even on LeBron. Which he would then try and post up, and then they were just bringing another defender all the way across the lane or even trapping. I mean, I think what you need to do if you're the Hawks on those post-ups, have Bazemore try and front pretty well, force him to throw a lob pass, and then you got to just bring the help hard all the way over to LeBron before he's able to get to the middle of the floor.
Yeah.
And make that a long pass to whoever it's going to be rather than a short one. But, you know, that's fraught with peril, too. You open up more space for cutters that way. You know, it's a further retreat to get back into the play for whoever's double teaming. I mean, the other thing that they might even try, too, is have Bazemore or whoever it is try and front. Force the lob over, and then you have the big man, either Millsap or Horford, especially if it's late clock, come over to double. And as soon as that guy gets there, you have the small guy, Bazemore, sprint away. So then you've just got the big guy kind of guarding one-on-one on LeBron in the post. Now, if there's enough time in the clock, LeBron can back out and try and attack off the dribble against Horford or Millsap. But maybe that's the way, is you just, it's kind of like a double, but you're sending, if the small guy is running away immediately to try and find someone, maybe that's your option.
I like it.
It's a thought. It takes a lot of coordination, not something that a lot of teams do, but they're going to have to get real creative now because they don't have anyone who can even pretend to stop him one-on-one in the post with the base lineups, at least.
And they also don't have a guy who can provide the offense and defense. I mean, so you're looking, you're getting more into specialist land, and that's dangerous when you're talking about, we talked about how that was a part of the challenge for Cleveland, was defending a team where you have these shooters all around the floor, and, you know, if it's Bazemore, then Bazemore can hit some shots, but he's not a shooter in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I mean, he can at least be semi-dangerous from the corners, and he's a nice cutter as well in the same fashion that Carroll is. But then the big drop-off, of course, is going to be now who's even going to take Bazemore's minutes. They don't really even have, like, another guy who's even close to a three-man coming off the bench now. So, I mean, then you're getting into Jenkins and Mack and Scott. You know, none of those guys are really wings. So, yeah, it's going to be a real struggle for the Hawks, and Bazemore, not a guy who plays a ton of minutes, is now going to have to play a ton of minutes.
Yeah, he is. You ready to move on to some of the other NBA news?
See, did I have anything else in this game? No. All right, yeah, let's move on. I guess I didn't say whether I thought the Hawks were sunk or not myself. I mean, with having lost game one at home already, that doesn't look good. And I think that so much of what makes their offense special is going to be kind of lost with Bazemore's shooting replacing Carroll. Their bench has just continued to look horrendous. They have not, most teams, the time to take advantage of the Cavs is when LeBron is out of the game. The Bulls weren't able to do that. Their bench played so badly. And now the Hawks are in the same predicament. So, yeah, I mean, it's not looking good. If they had maybe held on to win this game, I might have felt they'd still have a shot. But, yeah, with no Carroll, it's really going to be an uphill slog for them. So we can move on to a subject that I'm sure is precious to your own heart. DeAndre Jordan making first team all defense at the center position.
I mean, so here's the thing. DeAndre Jordan is not a bad defensive player. It's just that making him the best defensive center is inaccurate. It's just not what he does, unless you're counting offensive rebounding as defense, which I do not, because it is not defense. And so I think that the other point, there was a Dan Feldman brought this up about how it was kind of notable that the Clippers had two players make the all defense teams, despite having a almost exactly league average defense. And the only team that's ever done that before, or worse, was the last Bad Boys Pistons team, which had just fallen off. You know, the guys had gotten older. It was right before Rodman left. And so you do get that. And so, yeah, it's frustrating. But at the same point, I don't care that much about awards. I'm not as outraged as Isaiah Thomas was about Avery Bradley not making it, which I thought was kind of funny because he also referenced that players should have a vote and they're getting one. I don't know. I thought that was happening this year, but whatever. And so, yeah, it's frustrating. And I mean, I wrote my little tirade on Warriors World a little while back about it. And it's also frustrating to me because the way that the voting happens, and I hate this, is that it's required that there are positional groupings. And to me, center is a far more important defensive position. So Rudy Gobert, who had a great year, Nylon Calculus' rim protection stat, he was the best guy. He was a huge factor in the Utah improvement. Instead of, you know, maybe he gets quote-unquote snubbed off the first team or Bogut does, at least Bogut got on the second team. Rudy didn't get on at all. And that's unfortunate.
Before I go in on the voters, I do want to say that we've made some great advances in measuring defense and also in these awards rewarding good defensive play. Draymond Green never made even close to an all-defense team before. His first year as a starter, he was first team all defense. He was the forward. Tony Allen was at guard. Chris Paul, the other guard, and Kawhi Leonard was the small forward. So that's good that someone like Green can come out of nowhere in 1 year and get this type of recognition. There's an understanding that the Warriors are an elite defensive team. I think the tide has turned, at least with people understanding now that the Warriors are the best defensive team in the league, measuring by points per possession rather than just raw points per game. And that's a big hurdle for some of the more traditional media to have passed, to reward these guys who weren't necessarily household names. You at least don't have any of these guys who were good 5 years ago and are still hanging on, like Kobe Bryant for a while. That said, if you think that DeAndre Jordan is a better defensive center than Andrew Bogut or Rudy Gobert or Tim Duncan or any of just a myriad of other options, frankly, you're not watching closely enough, in my opinion.
Agreed.
You're not conversant enough in the relevant statistics. DeAndre Jordan has his strengths. I mean, he can get up and block a lot of shots, but he also doesn't really jump for a lot of shots. And he plays a lot of minutes to be sure, but I think he's very worried about foul trouble. And he thinks that, his bark is a lot more impressive than it actually is, because he'll let guys just go in and shoot layups without even jumping a lot of times. When he's really, really on his game, he can be at this elite level, but he too often is not quite there.
Yeah, I mean, the way that I like to describe it with DeAndre is that when I kind of got into basketball, especially when that information wasn't out there, I always had a passion for guys who could protect the rim and who are good defensive rebounders. That's the combination, because at that time, what I thought was a good rim protector was a guy who blocked a lot of shots. So if you look back, you can see some pieces where I talk about how I was so passionate about how Andre Drummond, his block rate and his defensive rebound rate were really great. And it's like, he has a lot of potential. If we were still in a world where those were the best stats that we could use to measure that, then yeah, that's justified. But thankfully, even though not all of the sport view data is publicly available, there are people who are doing great work with it. And you can watch a lot more games too. And so I expect more of people who, it's their job to not only to watch basketball, but their responsibility to vote on these things. But we can talk about that. But I wanted to ask you, I've harped on it before, do you support the idea of altering the positional definitions for the all-defense team?
Well, I do for pretty much anything that requires a position. You should have a point guard, two wings, and two bigs. That's because those roles are much more similar than having forwards, where you can get two power forwards on a team. Like, nobody plays that way anymore. You play with two wings, you play with a point guard, and you play with two bigs.
Yeah, I'm definitely with you on that. And yeah, and I think you opened it up. The other reason why that, like, I would support it, in the context of an all defense team is that center to me is the most important defensive position. So if you're saying a position is more important, then you should be able to put more of them on there, because especially when there are guys who do it well, that doesn't mean you have to. Like, that's
well,
why.
Is that what you're saying about it? I actually disagree with you. I think that there should be, one of everything, basically. I mean, I guess you could have two centers on there because they're both bigs. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. If you want to open it up that way, I would even just have no positions on it for me with defense. I would have them for all NBA, but for defensive team, I would open it up completely.
Well, the bottom line for me here, center is such an important defensive position that if you're league average, you better have four other corpses around you if you're going to try and be the defensive player of the year on a league average defense. Like, it just doesn't happen. Like, there's no way that we don't know exactly how defense adds up. We don't know what the sum of the parts is. But, A, they weren't really any better with him on the floor. And B, overall, their performance with him playing 38 minutes a game or whatever it is, maybe a little less than that, but, significant amount of minutes is an average defense. And there's just, however you want to slice up the individual components of defense, centers are so important that if he is the center on an average defense, not a great defense, there's just no way I can justify picking him for first team all defense.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to say, and I pulled up the stats while we were talking, I put this out on Twitter right after he got the defensive player of the year voting, but it's kind of amazing when you think that the main replacement was Spencer Hawes. Clippers opponents shot a larger proportion of their shots in the restricted area when Jordan was in the game than when he was out. It was 24.4 when he was off, 28 when he was in. The paint, in the paint, non-restricted was a little bit less, but still close. And both in the paint and in the restricted area, teams made a higher proportion of their shots. And so to me, even if that's noise, even if that's anything else, that says something, you know, that the teams aren't necessarily scared of him, and it's not like he had this, you know, shot-blocking dynamo as his backup, so you're getting that on and off. And he played a vast majority of his minutes with Chris Paul, who you chose for first-team all-defense. So it's just kind of crazy to me, especially when you consider that the Clippers don't have any guys in their starting five who are considered, you know, terrible defenders. I mean, Blake isn't great, but he's not bad, and JJ's been overly criticized. I thought he did a great job, particularly in the Rocket series. But it's kind of, I think people look the other way with DeAndre, and part of that's because Doc Rivers is such a magnetic personality, and he's a great campaigner. But when you really, whether you're using the eye test or you're using the numbers, the case just isn't there.
Other than him, any other sort of injustices or changes that you would have made? I thought they actually did a pretty good job overall aside from that one. I probably would have had John Wall on the first team. The second team, for those who didn't see, John Wall and Jimmy Butler at the guards, Anthony Davis and Tim Duncan at forwards, and Bogut at center. And I think Tim Duncan or Bogut would have been my first team center, or, you know, with Gobert, I can see the argument that he didn't quite play enough minutes. So,
sure.
That's but you know, he certainly on a per play basis was a little bit better. But yeah, I thought they did pretty well overall. Aside from that Jordan issue.
Yeah, I mean, I would have loved for Danny Green to get it, but I'm not going to argue Danny Green heavily over any of the guys who got it over him. So, you know, I liked the job he did this year. I also think that his fast break defense is kind of amazing, his transition defense. But I'm not going to say he deserved it over John Wall and just, you know, beat the chair down. He definitely, to me, didn't deserve it over Jimmy Butler, who had a much harder job. You know, he was doing a lot more stuff, and Danny Green's more of a great team defender, and so he deserves consideration, but I'm not sure he deserves to make the team. So I'll mention him, but it's more in consideration than giving him a spot.
One other little note on this, Andrew Bogut, for making the second team, got a $1.9 million performance bonus. Good for him on that. He said he's going to take the team to Chipotle, possibly Jamba Juice.
Well, and the other thing that does, this is something you and I have talked about before, is it changes the expectation of his bonus for the subsequent year.
Yeah.
And so while the Warriors aren't expected to have cap space anyway, it does change that in terms of the assumption during this upcoming offseason.
Yes, that's a good point as well.
We going back to the injury front?
Not yet. Actually, I wanted to mention that Steph Curry got fined $5,000 for flopping on a shot. It was the shot that put him up 9 that everyone was saying was such a spectacular shot. He had Terrence Jones coming up behind him. It was a quick release, kind of saw him out of the corner of his eye, thought he was going to get hit, and he landed with kind of a splayed leg position sideways, made the shot anyway. He got fined for a flop there. What did you think of that fine?
I didn't love it, but at the same time, you know, I did think in some ways that he was, you know, he was kind of looking for contact. But to me, a flop is a little bit different. I think a flop is exaggerating contact or acting like contact, which wasn't there. I didn't love it, but I can't say that I've watched it enough to have, like, this definitive opinion on it.
I thought that it wasn't good. I mean, it's obviously very arbitrary what you're going to get fined for. I mean, there are certainly, I could point to, and Coach Kerr said this, he acknowledged maybe that it was a flop. I actually don't think it was that bad personally. But, you know, as he noted, there are plenty of people who do that same thing all the time. There are plenty of other much more egregious flops. I mean, I thought Draymond Green's flop to draw that foul on Howard was probably more egregious than that, where he exaggerated contact, you know, when he was in the post and Howard kind of shook his arm off a little bit, and drew, I think it was Howard's fourth foul. But I think what needs to be understood there is if you're a shooter and you're in the air, especially Curry, a guy who's had ankle problems, and you feel someone near you and kind of, you know, there's going to be contact or you think someone might land underneath you, the reason you sort of land the way he did with your legs out, not in the same place, is so that you avoid coming down with your full weight. Either you're landing and you can kind of go off to the side, so you're not going to sprain your ankle, or you can just land one foot at a time or something else to avoid just coming down on someone's foot. And I think that's really what that was more than, and also he needed to get his momentum into the shot a little bit more to get it off quickly. So I didn't think that it was anything that was fine worthy in my personal opinion. I think it was more about a guy just natural instinct to protect himself.
Yeah, I think that's a good addition to the conversation. I agree with you, and Curry is definitely somebody who is aware of anything ankle related considering his history.
So we'll get back to a little more news of the day. One of those is that Howard's injury is a little bit worse than was initially reported last night. It was initially considered a knee bruise, contusion type of thing. We did see that there was a little bit of buckle there as Josh Smith hit Howard's leg kind of from about a 45 degree angle. And as it in fact turned out, he does have a knee sprain confirmed by an MRI, questionable for tomorrow. So that's too bad. I mean, you really wonder how effective he can be. His quote today was that he's going to try and give it a go, but if he's as effective or feels the same way he did after injuring it in game one, that he's not really going to be helping the team. And frankly, I would agree with that. What do you think?
I agree with that. I mean, that was something we talked about yesterday, is that there were some times that he didn't get back in transition. Sometimes that was because the Warriors had quick actions, but sometimes it was just that it didn't seem like he could get back. And so when you're playing 4-on-5 or you're playing 4-on-5 without your stopper or your rim protector in that sense, it's really hard. And so I think that's the right tact. I'm very disappointed. And the way that I think about, and this is true for me always in a 7-game series when a team is facing the possibility of going down 0-2, is you have to remember that if they lose that second game, regardless of the home road split, they have to win 4 out of the 5 remaining games. And that's real hard. And so that's why it's not a must-win game in that rigid sense for the Rockets, but it's very important. And Dwight Howard is a necessary, if not mandatory, component of that success, especially on the road. So hope he plays. Hope he is better than we expected, but It's a huge game for Houston. It'd be sad if he didn't get to participate.
Yeah, it's really a tough choice for them. You can say maybe give him some time to recover. We're on an every other day series here, basically, until right. I forget what the exact schedule is, but the next few games, at least, it's every other day. And so you could say save him for game three, but then what are your chances of winning game two? And then it's 94% of all teams ahead 2-0 end up winning the series. So That's definitely not where you want to be if you're Houston. Tough choice. I don't envy it for them. Two other little injury notes before we go. One is Nuggets center Yusuf Nurkic, who had a very nice rookie season out of Bosnia. He is having surgery to repair a partially torn patellar tendon, and he's going to be out, I think, for at least 4 months or so. A shame for him because he's someone who really needed to work on his skills, both his left hand, getting his body, getting a little better body composition. You have to imagine that's not going to happen real well. And his bid to take over the Nuggets starting center position next year probably is going to be retarded by the fact that he has this injury and isn't going to be able to work that well in the offseason.
Yeah, I thought he was one of the, I guess you'd call it, rare rookie success stories in the season. And I thought he did a nice job particularly after they traded Timofey Mozgov to the Cavs. And yeah, as you said, you know, that summer, and you hear this from players a lot, especially if you're, you know, talking to players at the beginning of the subsequent season, is that summer between your rookie year and your sophomore year is so huge, because that's when you know what you've gotten into and you understand the league a lot better. And so you know what to work on. And so you see a lot of players make an improvement, not just in terms of lifestyle and choices and things like that, but in terms of their game. And he's going to be limited in terms of that improvement, because when you have a torn patellar tendon, you know, that's not the type of thing where you can work on certain things and you do things like that, at least from my knowledge on the subject, which is admittedly limited.
Yeah, I've actually had that injury, although this was deemed a slight tear. Mine was basically like, you know, about 70%, but, you know, you're essentially trying not to bend your knee for quite some time, about 6 weeks, to let those sutures heal, where they just anchor the patellar tendon back into the bone. And it's definitely not good for him. Hopefully, since it's only a partial tear, it's something that won't be an issue for him in, you know, moving forward, other than just the missed development time. He's a guy who relies on his quickness a lot, which is kind of weird to say for a guy who weighs 280 and is 7 foot, but he's got incredible quickness for his size, great hands, also a developing rim protector, and a guy with his big body who I think will be able to carve out space down there pretty well with his post game. So a little bit of a blow there for the Nuggets. Another piece of news was that Carmelo Anthony started running again, lifting weights a little bit, but still won't necessarily be playing full court 5-on-5 until August. And that's a little bit longer than was initially reported, I think. It was a 4 to 6 month timetable. I guess he had the surgery kind of at the end of February, so he's right at the outside of that, if that holds. The surgery that he had was a debridement, I think is how you pronounce that, on his left patellar tendon. But I think the fact that he's out for this long, there's been some speculation by doctors, one in the New York Post, that there's more damage beyond that as well. And when you think about Carmelo's age, now 31, a guy who's never been the most svelte in the world, he's going to have basically been inactive for up to 6 months. You got to wonder now if his time as a superstar really may be coming to an end.
Yeah, it was definitely jarring for me. I mean, I obviously knew about the injury and knew all the stuff that was the stuff about, you know, that he was waiting to play in the All-Star game and all that snark and everything like that. But the Knicks need him as much as I criticize the contract. They need him in the short term if they want to be successful. And he's a great guy to have in the league. I mean, even if he's not at that superstar level, he's a very distinct offensive player. I think you could even go so far as to call him a unique offensive player. And yeah, I mean, I think that while he doesn't necessarily need his athleticism in that purest sense, it's something that is important when you think about it. You know, like the way that a player ages is that oftentimes defense is what goes first. And if this is something that sticks with him, and if, you know, if there's more there than they could even fix with this, then that becomes a really big question for the Knicks too, in terms of how you're thinking about him. You know, does that move him maybe more to the power forward position long term, and the consequences of that as well?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think Phil Jackson probably with the triangle, we don't know how much they're going to stick with that next year, but you would imagine that they probably would, is been a little bit loath to play him at the power forward, liking a bigger lineup. But yeah, his ability to hold up at the three, and especially since they don't really have anybody else on that team right now who can defend good wings on the other team. You know, Tim Hardaway, I think, you know, is kind of looking like the potential starting two at this point, you know, whether it's him or anyone else, that nobody who's really a great wing defender on that team. You know, they're hoping to make a splash in free agency with Carmelo not even healthy again, being the age that he is. They got the number four pick, which could be useful, but, you know, isn't quite as glamorous. So getting tougher and tougher to sell the idea of a championship contender emerging in New York, and to sell free agents on that same vision.
Yeah, it's getting really tough for the Knicks. And something else to remember is that in the 2016 draft, Denver has the right to swap their pick. And while I think the expectation for a lot of people was, oh, you know, Denver will be worse than the Knicks and they'll do that, that does linger in terms of all these kinds of decisions, because that takes away a lot of the, if you want to call it, quote-unquote, incentive to lose for the Knicks. And so, because if they, assuming, you know, that there's no benefit really there as long as they have the option of swapping.
All right, well, that's a good point, too. I mean, so they're going to try and get better, but that then could lead to some real bad potential contracts. At least they're limited in that, because the cap's going to be going up, so you're... If you use cap space this year, you're still going to have some probably next year.
Oh, wait, can I add something quick, too? I forgot that not only are they doing the swap, but they have to trade whatever pick gets swapped to Toronto. So it really doesn't matter. Right. So then there's really no incentive to lose.
Yeah, imagine that. They don't have incentive to lose. Well, in any event, yeah, I mean, I think that there's a possibility that they might end up overpaying because, you know, the idea is to get as good as they can as fast as possible. And, you know, something that we've seen from the Knicks previously when they had cap space in the summer of 2010, or then when they amnestied Chauncey Billups and signed Tyson Chandler, moves that made them get better, but ultimately didn't really put them close to championship contention, and then ended up biting them later. When, you know, they didn't have the amnesty for Amari Stoudemire, or they signed him in the first place in 2010. So it could just be more of the same for the Knicks. We'll see what ends up happening with that number four pick. But that's probably enough for today, a Wednesday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. Follow Danny on Twitter, Danny LaRue. I'm Nate Duncan, NBA. We're doing this pretty much daily, Sunday through Thursday nights, and perhaps on occasion, if there's a real good game over the weekend, we'll do an emergency podcast then. Hope to have some more cool guests coming on pretty shortly, so stay tuned for that. Subscribe on iTunes or at the Real GM page, and we will talk to y'all next time. Thanks.